emotions and feel at the mercy of them, and it's like I've got no control over this beast inside me, and when it triggers, I'm in, you know, I'm incapacitated. And so, and this is why controlling people, like my mother, say, try to control everyone around them and their environment so they don't have to feel their own feelings. But one interesting thing is you can actually generate feelings that you would like to have by going to see a movie that you like. You can go and see a scary movie if you want to feel afraid, or you can go and see a romantic movie if you want to feel love, or you can go and see an action movie if you want to feel excited. So you don't have to be at the mercy of your feelings. You can actually, there are some tools and processes, and one of them is just going and seeing a movie or putting some music on, where you can generate the feelings that you want to have. And I'm really interested in that side of stuff as well. In addition to just healing all the trauma and dealing with all of those unpleasant feelings, what about, hey, we could maximize some positive feelings? It's just that you've got to do both of those. And I know quite a lot of people that are really into positive energy and law of attraction and affirmations and all that stuff. And I love that stuff. Sometimes I think, yeah, you're kind of avoiding some pain here, I think. You're not really feeling all that real to me. So yeah, you need both those two things. This is a whole nother conversation I could talk about for hours, because I'm fascinated by all this stuff too.
Yeah, it's great. What are some of the things that you recognize? You talk about being controlling an environment, right? Mm-hmm. So the anxiety, and people can do that physically, they can do that emotionally, right? They can do that through the types of questions that they ask a person that allows them to, they try to control a conversation, right? Mm-hmm. So there's different ways that people could potentially do that. What are some of the other things that you observe with your clients that they do? And so if somebody's listening to this, they might be able to recognize this in themselves or in their environment.
Well, the one that springs to mind is about making judgments rather than expressing or recognizing feelings. And I got this idea when I studied nonviolent communication, which is a system Marshall Rosenberg, who was a psychologist, came up with. And he realized that the more intellectual training he had, like he had a PhD and he was highly trained at therapy and counseling, he realized that the more training he had on how to think, the less empathic he became and the less useful he ultimately was to his clients. So one of his ideas is just to recognize how you're feeling rather than the judgment. So if you've got some negative judgment about someone, and okay, maybe like the women you were talking about that label other women as sluts or as whatever, you know, bitch about other people, so they're making a lot of judgments that are negative, rather than going, oh, I'm jealous. You know, there's a feeling behind all our judgments, and ultimately the judgment's not going to help us deal with the trauma if there's trauma there, because the judgment is a protective layer that stops us. And like racism is an example of this too. Like, you know, I don't trust other people of other races because I'm actually an insecure person in myself, so I will put them down. And yeah, the extreme groups that, you know, neo-Nazi groups, that are kind of extreme examples of this. Rather than dealing with my own pain, I'll like label everybody else as bad in some kind of way, rather than going, yeah, I'm afraid of people that are not of my race. And that's a tribal thing. That's, to some extent, that's wired into us evolutionarily. So to function in the modern world where a lot of races intermix, if you want to do that effectively, there's some fear there you got to work through. But if you want to self-actualize and have a fulfilled life, I don't know any other way than to work through the fear that stops you connecting with other people. And the research shows that that's ultimately when the psychologists research like what makes people happy. You know, it's not the things you buy, it's not the job you have. I mean, job, all these things can contribute, but it's not where you live. It's the connections you have with other people that form a sense of lasting fulfillment. And even what you talked about, the novels where people are writing these great works of art and literature, are often talking about how people are navigating that social space. Like, how do you deal with the fact that we're inherently hierarchical, because that's wired into our brand, yet we've got to be able to connect with people for fulfillment. So you can't really just bully everyone to get to the top, because you'll be really lonely and unsatisfied. You need to be able to cooperate with people on that social stratum. And a lot of works of literature about that problem and the hero's journey of growing up, and like, how do you navigate a world that's uncertain and people that are uncertain, when some things tend to work and some things tend to not work, but there's no guarantees, as there's kind of big life questions underneath all these kind of things.
Well, yeah, I think these are all great points. Yeah, especially, I mean, I I like stories, especially these older stories, right? These, you look at sort of like older religious texts, or you look at old sort of older like Greek or Roman mythology, or which were also like their own sort of religious texts. Mm-hmm. You get these people, some people take them literally. And then, there's other people who sort of have found a way to use them as sort of, metaphors, and try to find like what is the lesson that's sort of being trying to be captured. I was watching a TED video the other day on narcissism. Mm-hmm. And the idea of the story of Narcissus, right? Like he's like the guy gets sort of obsessed with his own image in a pool of water, and then drowns in the pool of water because he can't love anybody more than he loves himself. Mm-hmm. Right? Like somebody observed that phenomena a long, long time ago, and then they observed it in the world around them and people around them, and they turned it into a story. But there's this really deep truth that's there, right? Like this person was so in love with themselves that they destroyed them. And maybe they didn't literally, maybe someone's not, I mean, as we become as we get older, and you talked about language, using language to, or using the process of thinking to sort of, it starts to cause people to disconnect. Mm. I think people hide behind language. Mm. So they'll use pretentious language or five-letter words or more sophisticated language to try to articulate things, and then they end up hiding behind that language. And sometimes improving our vocabulary can help us to better articulate what it is that we're feeling and seeing. I think for a baby who begins to use words and says, "I'm hungry," like it goes from not being able to express it, just cries, to saying, "I'm hungry." Like that's a progression. But as our language becomes more sophisticated, it becomes easier to hide behind our language. But going back to the story of Narcissus, this idea, like, okay, this person's so in love with themselves that they're disconnected from other people, yeah, and they destroy themselves in the process. Like that's universal, right? And so we can see that today around and all around us. And if you go back and you look at these old stories and you take them literally, it's like easy to reject them because you're like, well, that stuff doesn't exist, right? But if you think like, what are the main themes that are happening here? There's oftentimes a reason why people still find meaning even if they can't always articulate them thousands of years later, because there's this sort of deep human truths in some of these fables and mythology. And it sounds like you have something you want to add or say.
Well, I talk about universal human experience, and I relate to what you're saying. Part of my spiritual journey, if you want to phrase it that way, is I grew up in, like, we were Christians. We went to church every Sunday, which was part of the disconnect in my head, that my parents could be so horrible to each other emotionally, and yet we'd be taken to church where the preacher will be talking about love and then come home and have a screaming argument. And it was just like, oh, it's crazy. But I hung in there with it until my mid-30s, where I decided it was all made up and became an atheist. And then rejected the whole thing and threw it all out and went, no, none of that was true. Didn't ever happen. And then hung on to that. And I became quite militant as an atheist because it was important to be right. Like, my parents' arguments, being right was really important. You know, my sense of safety was even attached to that, because who was right and who was wrong was who was going to win or lose the argument. And if you lost the argument, you just got destroyed. So it was very important that I be right, and I tried to tell all my Christian friends that they were wrong, and became a real asshole. And then just recently I've been watching Jordan Peterson's series on the psychological significance of the Bible stories, and it's
amazing, right?
It's fantastic, man. That is just, I'd highly recommend that stuff. Because he's got this blend of, he really blends psychology with the spirituality stuff. And even the fact that I think he is theistic. Like, he really does believe in God. If you ask him, when interviewers ask him face point to point, he avoids the question. But I think really he does believe in that there's a God out there. I'm still an atheist, but hearing his interpretation of these stories helped me kind of put some of my anger about that to bed, because, like, oh, I wasn't lied to. It's just I was told a story that can be interpreted as a child one way and can be interpreted as, like, a middle-aged person another way, or as a more mature person in another way. And there's profound truth in all of it. But it doesn't mean it literally happened necessarily.
I've gone through a very similar process. And oh, wow. I found that I find his content absolutely amazing. And I don't think somebody needs to agree. I don't agree with everything that he says. You don't need to agree with everything someone says in order to get immense value out of it. And it's amazing how it affects me. Even I can use an example. We use something like Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Mm. And so people who are sort of religious fanatics will say, well, that's 'cause God is saying that all gay people are bad and it's a sin, and so we should create legislation that says people shouldn't have anal sex or we're going to put them in prison, which sort of happened with people like Taurine, right? Or what's the guy who wrote he's a writer, he's an English writer. I can't think of the book. But you could also think, well, if you think about that story as a sort of metaphor where, like, and this is not anything about, I'm not pushing any sort of views on homosexuality, and we definitely have gay clients, but if you have a society and everybody is gay, then you're not gonna have any kids in the society. Maybe God doesn't throw thunderbolts and destroy the society, but the society just, like, it won't continue to live on because there'll be no kids, right? So if you think about, so if you were to go back 3,000 or 4,000 years and you think, okay, somebody doesn't have the scientific tools that we have in order to describe society. They just know that, hey, when we eat pigs, we get sick, right? Because, and so pigs must be bad animals, or, and you find out as an adult, well, it's because there's certain parasites that need to be cooked over a certain temperature, and nobody knew that, and they weren't always cooking over a certain temperature. They just realized this is a problem, and it was a part of nature, and so they attribute it to God, and then they create these stories that allow people to sort of push this message forward so that the community can benefit from it, because you didn't have YouTube or the internet or these tools where everybody can just sort of look or organize school in the way that we do do in modern society. So you have these sort of these stories that people can listen to them and use them as guidance. And so as I listened to Jordan Peterson talk about some of these stories, these biblical stories, where you're right, like, as a kid, I took them literally, and I just said, well, this is inconsistent with science and it's wrong. And then I would also, as a young man, hear people who are sort of more militant and taking all of these things literally. And you say, well, how can you take like science, for example, which measures everything and sort of it's debatable and they have their own sort of peer process for sort of sorting out ideas, is constantly rediscovering things every 3, 4, 5, 10 years in certain industries, or sometimes on a daily basis in others. And how can a theory on sort of the way the world was created and evolved be accurate? Like, how can you take that as fact from something 3 or 4,000? How can you take that literally? And I agree with you. I think with Jordan, whether somebody's listening to this and they're religious or not, I think that there are, one of the things I've learned from listening to Jordan is that there are deep meanings behind some of these stories. And whether it's a religious text, in any religious text, or it's a mythology or a fable, there's definitely things that if you pull back, you take off your literal hat for a second and you ask yourself, and you'll say, well, there's meaning there that's useful, right? And there's a reason why this has value to people and potentially have value in my own life. Doesn't mean that it will, right? Doesn't mean that every story is going to resonate with you, but it might give you a little bit of empathy.
Yeah, for sure. Well, there's some reason why these stories have prevailed. And it's because they tap into some universal thing in the human psyche. And yeah, whether that's, you think that was created by a god, or whether it's just a process of evolution guided by natural selection, it doesn't really matter. Like, the thing is, we read it and there's part of us that resonates. I'm currently reading the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and I'd never actually sat down and done that before because I thought I didn't have time, you know? I was like, well, hang on, what if I let go of my time anxiety and just went, well, this could be a fun story and people love it. I've seen the movies and the movies are great. And it's an archetypal story about the hero's journey. Is Frodo's going to save the world by destroying the Ring of Power, and he's just a hobbit. So he's like a child that needs to go out and experience the world and grow up and face a series of challenges, and he's going to have to overcome them, and people will come and support him, and people will come and get in his way, and some people are going to die along the journey, and he's got to make some clue-y decisions, even though he doesn't have a whole lot of life experience in the big world. He's going to have to work out how to navigate all this. And Gandalf is there to give him guidance when he needs it. But he's not always there. Gandalf nicks off sometimes. He's got his own stuff to do. And yeah, it's a metaphor for the journey that every human being goes on in the process of, or you don't always have to go on it because some people choose not to ever really grow up. But it's a metaphor for the people that want to grow up to go from being a defenseless child incapable of dealing with an uncertain world to an adult who is able to deal with an uncertain world. And yeah, you're right. The childhood interpretation I had as a kid was this got to be literally true. And it's just, that's a way of dealing with anxiety. Like, I can manage my anxiety if I can know what's true and how things work. But a more adult response to that is to go, okay, there is uncertainty in the world. The world tends to work a certain way, and some people describe that as God. Like, if you interact with the world in a certain way and you follow these rules, then the world will tend to react back in a way that is good for your life. And so there are commandments and rules that you can follow which will help you. But there's no guarantee of all those things. And so you kind of nailed it when you said you don't agree with everything Jordan says, but there's a lot you've learned from him. And I think that is a very adult, mature way of approaching a mentor. All my mentors, I realize, looking back, have been flawed human beings, because we all are, but I've learned a lot from them. And I've seen people go, no, I'm not listening to that guy anymore because he did this one thing that I don't approve of. And I'm like, okay, that's a bit black and white thinking. All that other stuff is still valuable. There's still meaning in all those stories that I could apply if I want to. I don't have to throw the whole thing out just because it's like, I don't agree with this one thing. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things that I liked when you started off this interview. You said, look, I don't have all of life figured out. I just realized that I was a few steps ahead or something that to that effect. And I find with coaching, that's generally true. Right. So I know it is in my business. I don't feel like I understand every aspect of life. And as I get older and I hopefully am becoming more self-aware, I find that I question myself more and more and more. And I question sort of the world and I'm constantly sort of like being exposed to sort of more ideas and perspectives. And when I was younger, I saw the world more in black and white. And as an adult, I realized there's just a lot of damn shades. Yeah. Problems are complex. Issues have lots of stakeholders. And the question is, like, for with Craft or Charisma, at least, I realized, I mean, a long time ago that at least within the context of the things that we were coaching, we were quite a few steps ahead in that journey that our clients are going on. And so there was immense value for them as we shepherded them through their journey. Right. And so that character, that idea of the sort of the shepherd or the guide, Gandalf, the whatever, it shows up in lots of different places in the stories that we see on screen and on paper and books, or we hear in songs or whatever, the stories that sort of carry through our society we hear this and see this all the time, and you don't have to. I love that idea. Like, as I remember as an adult, as I became an adult, actually I had a conversation the other day with a teacher. I was going to New York. There's this thing called Shakespeare in the Park. And you have to get up really early in the morning and you go out and you wait in line for tickets, and you have to wait for, I usually 5, 6, 7 hours to get these tickets.
Oh, wow.
And so people do it every year, and they do a couple shows a year. And it's really amazing. One of the reasons I think Shakespeare is considered one of the greatest writers of all time is because hundreds of years later, his stuff resonates so strongly.
Yeah.
You watch, I was with this girl that I'm dating, and she was watching, she'd never been to Shakespeare in the Park. And she's like, wow, like, did they modify this? And I said, what do you mean? She goes, did they modify this so it's current? I said, no, this is what he wrote in the native language. He wrote this in English hundreds of years ago. And that's why it's so powerful, because like, you watch it today and it resonates. Like, it is just, you're like, that's me. Like, that's me, or that's somebody I know. Like, it's just so clear. And, but this idea of sort of mentors, one of the guys who was in line with me, he was a teacher, and the guy behind me in line was a teacher. And he was talking about how I asked him, what were the grades that you enjoyed teaching the most? He was retired. And he said, junior high was really fun, but he goes, I really liked high school. He goes, junior high, he said, is interesting because a lot of the kids are, he goes, they have a lot of energy. He goes, but they still respect adults. But as they become, they get into high school, they start to question the people who are, they start questioning the judgments, decisions, and start seeing the flaws of the people who are sort of their mentors. And for me, that process was like, there were stars in the sky. And these were the people who were around me who sort of raised me, and they started to fall. Right. And so I started becoming cognizant. You talked about being an, being a 5 year old and not knowing the difference. Well, you're getting to high school and you start to say, well, I go visit my friend's house and their parents don't seem to fight like this, or my friend's parents are able to express themselves in a way my parents can't. And so you start to get these different, as my grandma says, she goes, I put my whole family in a line. And one of the things I realized that is that if I put them all on a line and they see something, every person will see it from a different angle. Oh, and that's an interesting visual metaphor, but it's true from an emotional perspective. People have different life experiences and lenses and traumas and whatever. And so sometimes they see the same thing from different perspectives, and that creates conflict as adults. But as we become sort of more independent and we get a little bit older, we get into sort of high school and college and we start getting these different experiences, we start to get different perspectives and angles than, or increasingly different angles and perspectives than the people who raised us, right? And so my mom used to say that she thought school ruined kids. Well, you just change, right? Like you're starting to get other people's viewpoints and perspectives, especially when you get off into like college, like the college level, or you start to travel or whatever. But go ahead, but in any point, I wanted to share some of those things.
Oh yeah, look, there's a lot of things there. You reminded me of one point. I do recall quite vividly going on a picnic when I was very young. I'm guessing around 7. All that stuff happens at 7. That's a key age where your brain's kind of developing. And I remember going on a picnic with a friend of mine from primary school who lived up the street, and he was a bit of a wild kid. Like, he was quite rambunctious. I'm like, so was I, but his parents, I don't think, put the lid on that, whereas my mum was like, don't run in the house, you know, it's not okay. Anyway, I went on a picnic with his parents, and I could tell immediately that they loved each other. Like, I could just feel something, and they would hold hands, like they had more physical intimacy, and I remember just feeling like something. It's one of those moments where you go, hang on, something's wrong in the world. I hadn't noticed up until now. But I was like, wow, I can so tell that these people love each other. And I knew that they weren't Christians. They didn't go to church. My parents, we went to church every week. And yet, I didn't have this same feeling when I was around my parents. And it came down to they were just really comfortable with each other. My friend's parents were just really comfortable with each other and had a lot of affection and empathy for each other. And even though, I mean, I guess they were nice to me because they took me on a picnic and they gave me some food and stuff, but it was just something about being in their presence. And I went, oh, hang on, something's wrong with the world because my parents don't have that. And I knew, you know, I knew quite young I could spot that. I didn't know how to deal with it at the time. I hadn't learned, you know, what I needed to do to deal with this stuff. But it's kind of funny thinking back to those things. The other thing that I was thinking was there's a guy called Joseph Campbell who I also found tremendously interesting. He was a mythologist that studied stories from all different cultures. And he came up with the idea of the hero's journey, which is a narrative of this process of development of growing up, essentially. And George Lucas was very influenced by him, which is why the Star Wars
and Jordan Peterson,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I haven't heard him say that, but I mean, the idea of maps and meeting, like, this is all derivatives of, I haven't read that book, I ordered it recently.
Yeah, cool.
But his biblical series is all, I mean, they're derivatives of Joseph Campbell's work, in my opinion. But keep going. I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, right. Well, for me, Joseph Campbell kind of distilled down like why these stories prevail, like from an evolutionary sort of societal and story evolution perspective, like why do these stories persist over time. And I was talking to a friend at college. We talk about all sorts of stuff while we're having lunch. We don't always just talk about music, and we were talking about religion, and this friend of mine is very anti-religious, and I was like this too during my anti-Christian phase. And he got quite defensive about, you know, the abuses in the church and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not really what it's about. Like, you know, and I can now see there's value in these stories because they teach you rules about how to live your life. And Jordan's just released a book, which is a bestseller now, called 12 Rules for Life. Who would have thought that a book telling you how to live your life would be so popular? But with the decline of church attendance, not as many people are like learning this stuff. So we want to get it somewhere because learning everything from first principles is hard. So I had a point there. Oh yeah, and at the end of this discussion, which had got a bit heated with this friend of mine, he said, do you think humanity will ever let go of this kind of childish need for these stories, you know, these made up stories that to him have no value? And I said, you know, to be honest, I don't think it ever will, because the problem is, how do you teach a broad range of people that are all at very different points on the developmental spectrum and on kind of their spiritual evolution, how do you teach them profound truths about how to live so that they don't have to suffer? And the way that has evolved is you tell them a story that a child could understand and appreciate. Oh, Jonah got swallowed by a whale. And then an adolescent could kind of go, oh, okay, Jonah rebelled and didn't do what God asked, so it didn't always go his way. And then an adult could go, okay, so Jonah needed to take a bit of time out before he could go to Nineveh. And then as a more mature person to the end of the life, you might say, right, yeah, Jonah, yeah, it's just part of life, you know. Life throws you challenges, and whether it's really there's a God up there that's telling you to go do things, or whether it's just the way the universe works, means that if you do certain things, your life will be happier. And if you avoid those things, you're going to end up in the belly of the whale for a while.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I also don't know if authors always write with the intent of trying to communicate a specific message. I think sometimes they're like your music, they're just trying to get something out, right? Oh, yeah. So maybe it's something that they observe in the world, or maybe it's something that they observe in themselves, or maybe it's them, they're making up some type of story because it allows them to sort of hide behind it while they sort through through things that are going. I know a friend of mine from the Times at one point, he writes for the New York Times, sounds super pretentious, but he wanted to write a book about me and early on in my coaching career, and he ran it by some publishers and like was having trouble figuring out how to sell it. But when he made the main character, he didn't want to put himself in the story because he was worried that he would that his kids might judge him, right? And so he sort of created a fictional character that was sort of a compilation of things he was observing, but mostly it was him. And other people might do this with like a fish or a bunny or like what some other person, but they're just trying to get, as we talked about earlier, sort of moving a little bit more full circle. They're just trying to get something out of their system and articulate to the world that they might not be able to fully process. And what happens is the stories that resonate the most, I think, sort of like shift out and survive because people connect with them. And then they sort of derive meaning, and it feels like they were written with the intent of communicating a certain message. And maybe that is the case, but my experience when I think about the people I know who write, or my friends who write, usually sometimes they're trying to get some specific message out, but oftentimes they're just sort of they're sorting things out. Like I watched Stephen King the other day do an interview, and he was saying, look, like I oftentimes ask myself a question, and then those people just come alive in my mind, and I just write down what they're doing. And I've experienced that I'm writing a short story or something, and I just ask myself a question: what would happen if? And then as I ask sort of some additional questions, that creates additional questions. I ask those additional questions. Sort of this imaginary play comes alive in my mind, and right. I just sort of write it down. And so, I guess. Go ahead.
So I'm curious about that. Does it feel like this, the creativity or the stuff that you're writing is coming from somewhere, or do you feel like you're channeling it, or how does it feel for you?
I think it's funny because I think in another time people thought it was driven by sort of religion, right? There's somebody who's speaking into my mind and my consciousness. But I think honestly, it's just sort of my imagination, right? Yeah. It's just like I ask myself a question, like what would happen if. I remember I wrote a short story and I asked myself, what would happen if I wasn't, if I was conscious and nobody knew that I was?
Ah, yeah, right.
So what would that be like? And what would happen? And so then I didn't use myself. I didn't do it literally. I wrote a story about a woman who was in a coma and nobody knew that she was still conscious. And she had this incredibly alive mind where she was hypersensitive to everything that was happening, but she couldn't move, right? Her eyes were open, but she couldn't express that in any way. And so it's all explores all the emotions and reaction to stimulus and environment. And so I think sometimes these questions, asking for myself, my own creative process, and the only person I've ever heard say this is Stephen King, and he obviously does it much better than me, but he's built a whole career off that. But sort of asking myself a question, and my mind just sort of like answers it, right? Because it's a tendency. We, if we ask ourselves a question, our brain will try to solve it, right? Whether we make up a story or we start measuring things and sort of doing systematic tests, our brain will start to try to solve that. And I think some of these things that can't be measured or they're hard to measure, sometimes we can explore them through metaphor, through story. And I find that that's true for myself.
So you ask yourself, what if, and then you just let your creativity kind of run with the scenario.
Yeah, well, that's actually an acting technique, right? Like Stella Adler, going back to method acting, there's different schools of method acting, and some say that you should go back and dig into a traumatic experience and use that as a catalyst to enter a scene, or you enter. So, like, if someone's listening to this, they've never taken an acting class, you feel depressed, the scene calls for you to be depressed or excited or happy or anxious. So you think back a time when you felt those emotions. The problem is, like, you can't ever express those things to other people, because then it starts losing its power. And what you're trying to do is just enter the scene with that sort of emotional catalyst, so that your partner can react to you, then you can react to your partner, like that sort of, because it's hard to sort of read words and just feel the emotion. And you need, if you're going out and performing on a consistent basis, not every word you read is going to touch you or affect you the same way emotionally, but you still have to be able to consistently perform and give a consistent product. Otherwise, you're never going to have a career in this, whether it's as in a volunteer theater or whether it's on television or in stage or in front of the most exclusive audiences in the world, or the biggest audience in the world, the biggest stages. So that's one approach where, you go back and you mine your experiences. Maybe if you have things to add, but for someone who's listening, you mine your experiences, you use that as a catalyst, but you can never express them or let them out, because otherwise they lose their power. Another way, this sort of another approach, is this imaginary circumstance where you say, well, what if this happened? What if my mom died or my dog died? Or what happened if I went out and did this and I was embarrassed? And so you imagine that situation, and then that sort of, you let that affect you, and then you use that as a catalyst. So I'm not necessarily saying what if, but I am, right? So I'm just saying, I guess what would happen. Yeah, I guess I am saying what if, right? It's funny. I'm thinking through this.
Well, it's funny how powerful those things can be. And, you know, in terms of our topic, which was charisma and confidence, these things can work. Like, I'm often dealing with trauma, because trauma, when it gets triggered, can undermine this. But once you've dealt with some of that stuff, it can be quite powerful to just say, what if I was to act as though I had a lot of charisma and confidence? And not like in a cocky, arrogant, or dickhead kind of way, but just like, how would I walk, you know? And, you know, their acting techniques are based on this. And I noticed when I was studying acting and I was reading books about Stanislavski's, some of the techniques he came up with, I was like, oh, these are the same techniques the trauma healing people are using, like lying on the floor and just shaking, and, you know, just weird things to get you out of your head and into your body. Actors, and I liked the acting take, because it was very pragmatic and practical, and like the acting teacher's intent wasn't necessary to heal his students' trauma. It was to allow them to be freely, fully self-expressed on stage. But it turns out those things are much the same. So yeah, I kept coming across as, wow, you just act as if. Just, I'll walk as though. And, you know, physiologically it makes a difference. A lot of some NLP techniques are based on this. Like, if you were to walk confidently, how would you be? You'd be standing upright. Your head would be up. You'd be like, I'm the master of my destiny here. And, you know, just sitting here and doing this while I'm talking to you, even though you can't see me doing it, you know, I'm starting to feel like, yeah, I'm in control of my life here. So, and it's surprising how effective these things can be. Just act as if.
You're just asking questions and answering them, right? So how would I stand? Yeah. How would I look? How would I move? How would I interact with people if I was, excited or anxious or happy? Yeah.
And I was on stage confident. The other day at a gig, performance gig, for my end of term for college, and I was playing bass, and I'd never played bass in front of an audience before. It's a bit of a new instrument for me. And the inner critic started going off, and suddenly, oh, the people don't like me, and I'm crap, and I'm a shit bass player. All this stuff's going on, and I remembered something that I read in a book called The Inner Game of Music, which is another, because musicians are dealing with this stuff too, so there's books for that. And one of them was just play as though you're a particular person. And I thought, who's a famous bass player? And the only one I could really think of was Paul McCartney, was the bass player in the Beatles. He plays guitar too, but at the start he was their bass player. So I thought, all right, I'll play as though I'm Paul McCartney. And suddenly I'm a rock star. And I wasn't thinking those negative thoughts anymore, and I could focus on enjoying playing the song.
Well, it gives you a way to sort of manifest the behavior if you're anxious about doing it yourself, right?
Yeah.
And so,
like, how do I access my inner rock star? Because there's a part of us, you know, we all have an inner rock star. It's just sometimes it's kind of been beaten down a lot. And it was fun. Made it like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. That sounds, well, it's funny because as kids, we do this innately, right? Like, we imagine that we play house or something. You imagine you're like daddy, you imagine you're mommy, or you imagine that you're an actor, or you imagine that you're a politician, or you imagine that you're a doctor, or you're an astronaut. Mm. And essentially you're trying on these different behaviors, and like you're free to open, but you're free and open to sort of exploring or beginning to explore these things. But as we get older and we get socialized and we sort of get put into our boxes, we become more self-conscious and we worry about our ego and our status and fall from grace or whatever, and we become more contained.
Yeah.
Generally.
Sends a shiver down my spine just thinking about it. Yeah. So I want to reverse all that stuff and get back to that childlike state where your creativity is just flowing and you haven't learned to judge it harshly yet. And like, I'm fascinated by the whole unconscious creative process. I think you made a really good point when you said that writers are not necessarily trying to put all these ideas in their narratives. They're just asking an intelligent question and then seeing what flows from it. Some of my most creative work has come unconsciously. Like, I wrote a song in a yoga class, and it sort of just came to me. And I could understand why people could believe in channeling things from some higher dimension or something, which is totally out of left field for my engineering wired brain. But yeah, I could see why I have that feeling, because this song pretty much came to me just in one hit, and I had to go home and work out what the chords were that I'd heard in my head and write the lyrics down, and then I went and recorded it and released it, and it was a big process of creativity. But it was fired up by just an unconscious feeling, and it was my rage that my life wasn't going the way that I wanted. And so it was titled Everything Is Fucked. And it turned out a lot of my fellow students at college who are straight out of high school and in that rebellious teenage phase really related to this message.
Well, it's true. It's funny. I mentioned earlier about rap being the music that's all about come up. It isn't all about come up, but you hear a lot of like come up type music. But you hear, when you listen to rock, for example, it's oftentimes people breaking away, right? And sort of that anger. And if you look at sort of the demographic of the people who listen to these different types of music, it would make sense why these different stories or messages would resonate, right? If you grow in a more, in a financially stable family, or more financially stable, but you still don't, you feel misunderstood, yeah, you're going to listen to something that's going to be more, it would make sense that someone would listen to something that's more angry and that they could relate to, because they're able to identify, I'm a middle class kid or upper class kid or whatever. But if you're a kid who's poor and you're like, I just want to make money, yeah. I want people to respect me. I want to be able to walk in, so I want people to notice me. I want people to be willing to listen to what I'm saying and not be judged in the same way. You're going to be interested in sort of the come up. These different stories resonate with us when we identify with them, right? And so you're going through something about where you're angry or frustrated, and you find a creative outlet that's helpful for dealing with it. Yeah, you're going to find an audience who's going to resonate, who's going to resonate with the same type of emotions that they're feeling. And it's funny because I have a friend of mine who was in a rock band when we were younger, and he said, you know, sometimes I'll write music And people will come up to me afterwards, and it'll be some guy, kid who is, I mean, a few years younger than him. And so he's just further along in the process, right, of discovering himself, or potentially further along. And he goes, he'll ask me, like, how are you feeling? Or what did you mean? Or, and he's looking for like this super deep human, sort of deeper human sort of explanation, because this song connected and resonated in so many different ways. My friend's like, well, I don't know. It's like sounded good, or just kind of like it, I was trying to express something I couldn't articulate, and there, and in their mind, like it connected, they connected to on a whole nother level. Yeah, and, and so in he, what he, when I look back, he just, he was going, he just thought it sounded good, but even his choice of what sounded good was like an expression of something that was underneath that he was trying to sort of get out, or the genre of music sort of resonated a certain way. But it's sort of interesting how we derive meaning.
Yeah, totally. And I my personally, my preference is to try and not overanalyze that now. But it reminded me of a time, again, I'm thinking about how the subconscious works and how it's always trying to match patterns, and we're not aware of it because it's subconscious, so naturally it's below our consciousness, but it's always there, and it's really, really powerful, more powerful than our conscious mind. And I was playing a song on drums by Boston Shuffle, I think it was called. I can't remember what it was called. But anyway, I was playing this song, and I thought I was playing it just because I really liked the beat. And often, if there's a song I really like the beat, I'll play it on drums. If I really like the melody, I might play it on keyboard or guitar or whatever. So I'm playing this song on the drums. I'm thinking, wow, this is a great song. I was really enjoying mastering and learning how to play it. And then I looked at the words, and when I read the words, I was like, oh my God, this song, or my interpretation of it, is totally about the drama that I'm currently going through in my relationship with my mother, because I just stood up to her for the first time and really said, it's not okay for you to treat my father like this around me. And when I read the words, I was like, oh my God, I thought I was just drawn to this song because I really liked the drum beat. And yet the words totally speak to me. And the words are basically saying, look, it's going to be okay. You know, we'll get through this. I was like, and you know, you could just say, well, that's just a meaning I made up about that. And the original author may never have intended that. And that may well be true. But I was like, wow, it's not just the beat. This is actually speaking to me.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter as long as you derive meaning from it in a way like that. That's useful, right? And it helps you.
Well, it comforted me in a painful time in my life. It's like, yeah, you know, it's right. I will get through this. It's going to be a bit tough for both of us, but we will survive. And on the abandonment theme, one of my mentors described what I now call cutting the emotional umbilical cord to your mum, like learning how to be your own man regardless of what your mother is feeling. I heard that described as learning to tolerate a parent's distress. And I see this in my clients all the time. They're very worried about upsetting their mother, and I'm like, look, your mother is a human being, and there are things in life that are going to distress her, so you don't need to go out and deliberately do things to upset her. But if you're going to be your own man, you need to learn to tolerate the fact that she's not going to approve of everything you do, and sometimes she'll be upset, and you'll need to go, well, I hear that you're really upset, Mum, and I need to do what I need to do.
That's a great point. When I was thinking a couple of things, I had a client the other day, and we were talking about expressing what he's feeling or what he wants, and I'm like, you're going to express that, and sometimes it's not, people aren't going to like sort of what you think or what you feel, and there, but it gives you, by being honest, people talk about women will often say like, oh, I just want a guy to be themselves, right? And guys are like, well, I've been being myself my entire life and it's not working. But but are they really being themselves? Like, are they fully expressing themselves? Are they being honest? Like, and these are hard things to do. And I told him, I said, look, just tell, like, in the specific situation, I'm like, just tell the girl what you need from her and let her react. And you might not get the reaction that you're hoping for or want, but just put it out there and let her react. And one of the things that he's learning is when he does this, when he says, hey, I need this from you, he might not get it right away. She might throw a temper tantrum or disagree or storm out.
Yep.
But as long as he's being reasonable, that's all he can do. And what will happen is he's not intentionally trying to hurt her. He's just telling what he needs and he's expressing that. And he didn't think he could do that growing up. And so he realized that she might go back and have to process this, but she'll come back a week or 2 weeks later and she'll have changed a little bit. And he thought he was helpless in these situations. Mm. And what he's discovering is he's not helpless, that when you're a 5-year-old and you upset your mother or you upset the people around you, you have to really worry about what are the consequences of upsetting them, and are you going to get abandoned, both whether it's emotionally or physically? Like, are these people going to protect you because you need their protection for survival? Mm. And so some of these things carry on. But what he's learning is these things that he picked up as a young man or as an adolescent or as a child, that as an adult, like, he needs to, it's important to be himself, express what he's feeling or thinking, try to name it, try to get it out, try to articulate it. And it's through that language you're going to structure the relationship, right? You structure the world around you, structure the relationship. And what all he can do is express those things, be honest about them, and let the person react. So that was sort of one thing that came to my mind. Another thing that came to my mind, I had another client who told me, it's a 6-year-old man, he said, I didn't feel like I could fully express myself till my mom died. I didn't feel like I could be in a relationship with a woman until my mom died, because,
wow.
And those are two different things, I want to talk about the second one more than I want to talk about the first. But he said, my mom was I was so concerned about sort of my mother's reaction, my mother's validation or whatever, that I couldn't be in a relationship with somebody else, with another woman. And so I found that really fascinating. He didn't think he could do it till literally his mother died. Mm. The third thing I wanted to bring up, and this is sort of a different tangent, but I think it's worth articulating. I had a friend of mine who's a professor at NYU and Columbia and New School. These are all city colleges in New York City. Mm. And she talks about when you're writing, she thinks one of the ways, the best ways to get published, she even wrote a book on this. She's written like 10 or 11 books at this point, and I'm sure she'll continue to write and get published. She says you write about some of your worst experiences, and she goes, you make them your best experiences. Mm-hmm. And so she talks about basically writing, the power of writing about traumas. And then she goes, a lot of times we're anxious and inhibited. It's hard to do. It's scary to put these things out there. Yeah. And then if you're someone who wants to write, you want to get published, you want to build a career around this, use these things to get your first work published, and or you get your first book published, and you use these things to make it the best experience of your life.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a really fascinating way to think about, if for somebody who's doing art, to express them. And you don't need to publish a book. Maybe it's the first time you walk on stage as a comedian, or the first song that you ever wrote and that you're actually proud of, or maybe it's just the first song that you ever wrote and there's something to be proud about that, or maybe it's something that turns into a hit, or maybe, I mean, there's like different levels of success. You don't always need to be, like, the definition of success doesn't need to be critical acclaim. It can just be literally the simple things, being able to articulate what I'm feeling, or articulate what I'm feeling to another person, or doing something that I've never done before. And because there's a growth process, an expansion process, where you're no longer letting these things control you. You're beginning to sort of expand. Does any of this resonate with you?
Oh, or? Yeah, totally. Look, this is my whole life journey you're talking about here. You know, getting to the point where things that used to be traumatic and very upsetting, I can now laugh about and laugh with other people about, because part of my fear about being a comedian is that people are going to laugh at me. And part of me wants them to laugh at the stuff that I want to be funny, but I also really want to be taken seriously, because these are all basic human needs. And
it sounds funny, right? You want to be taken seriously as a comedian.
Yeah, totally. I don't want people laughing at me because I'm a goofball, silly, you know, the kid that's still being bullied by the audience. That never feels good. And, you know, I sense the energetic difference when it's like people are on my side and they're like, yeah, you go, Graham. And when people are like, yeah, we're actually laughing at you because that passive-aggressive part of us that, you know, needs someone to bully is choosing you as a target.
That's fascinating.
And I like that. And I sense the energetic difference feels totally different to me. And I've recently been going to a laughter club, and the premise of this laughter club is we laugh for no reason. So it's sort of the antithesis of what I want to do as a comedian in terms of being on stage, but I'm going because I'm finding it healing to just be able to lie on the floor with a bunch of people and laugh and be silly and get over my inner critic that judges silliness because my mother couldn't tolerate it. And anyway, the woman that runs it keeps singling me out and making jokes at my expense. And which is against the charter of the club, and it's against what she teaches when she's running trainings on this stuff. And she said that last week, and she comes to me and said, I don't know why I do that. And I said to her, well, you know, I'd prefer that you didn't. And usually I make a joke in response to her singling me out, because I just want to diffuse the tension and I don't want to, you know, get upset. But it doesn't feel good to be treated in a way that I don't like. And I said to her, yeah, I'd really prefer if you didn't do that. And she goes, I don't even know why I do it. I suspect she's got something going on that might be worth her exploring, but I wasn't there in a coaching capacity, and boundaries are really important. It's the key thing I teach my clients. So if I'm at something like I'm participating in a club, like my laughter club, I'm not there as a therapist or a coach. I'm there as just a participant like everybody else, and I'm not dispensing wisdom. I'm not trying to crack jokes because that goes against the ethos of the thing. I'm not there as a comedian. I'm just a human being. So yeah, and it felt really good to stand up to her and say, look, I really don't like it. Even if you're doing it sort of playfully and in fun, it's not feeling good to me. And she's like, yeah, it goes against what I teach anyway. And I'm like, yeah, it's incongruous. So
did she bring it up or did you bring it up first?
She brought it up. She brought it up in front of the group, which was also a bit weird. So I think she's got a bit of insight into her behavior that's not appropriate.
Well, it's funny because sometimes, I mean, different things can be triggers, right? And so who knows what the trigger is for you, right? Like it could be anything from something you say to something about your personality to your reminder of an ex or she's attracted to you. Like it could be all kinds of different things. But I mean, it's great that at least she's able to, or your mind of her dad, who knows, but at least she was able to articulate it, because then you can begin to have a conversation about it and it's not you feeling insecure about it, right? I made me think of situation I had with a girl that I was dating, and she was trying to be really sexy, and I went and met her at this after a wedding, and they'd been drinking since basically the wedding was at like 11 in the morning. I don't remember exactly what time, but somewhere around 11. Let's say that they went and went somewhere afterwards at 2, and then they were out there till however long, and they had dinner. So they'd been like sipping on wine basically all day long, I don't know, 10 hours or something. And nobody was like stumbling, but everybody was buzzed. And gosh. I get there at like 11 at night or something. And everybody is on a whole nother vibe, 'cause I've been doing other things all day, not drinking and not sort of in this environment or whatever. And so anyway, we get home and she's trying to be really sexy. Mm-hmm. And I just started laughing, and she got really upset, and we couldn't talk about it till the next day. But she goes, remember when I tried to be sexy and you laughed at me? Yeah. And I knew that I had to address it, because I'm like, I had to bring it up, because otherwise I didn't want to create a trauma in her. And I just said, look, you were on a different, a wavelength than I was last night, because you, and the same thing I noticed when I went to the party, even before we went back home, because everybody had been drinking and they went through a wedding. That's an emotional experience. There's all these different things that are happening. They were just on a different wavelength. And for you, you thought you were being sexy because you thought you were being sexy and you're a little buzzed or whatever, 'cause you've been drinking. And for me, like I just was on a different emotional plane. Like and it was hard for me to get on that same emotional plane with you, because I didn't go through any of the experiences that you had just gone through. So I knew that I had to bring it up and talk about it with her, because I didn't want to create a trauma. And so I was saying, look, I didn't mean to laugh at you. I wasn't, I'm not making fun of you in any way. I think that you are sexy. I just was on a different wavelength. And sometimes in life it just happens. Yeah. Right. And, it happens sometimes in relationships, sometimes within relationships, it happens in certain situations, and it's normal. And I'll even argue that in some ways it's unavoidable, but what we can do is we can talk about these things afterwards so that they don't become permanent pieces of the trauma that we develop with another human being, or totally. And affect both ourselves and our other relationships. Because the last thing I want her to do is think that she can't be sexy around me, right?
Because, totally. We don't want to shut that down. No,
we definitely don't want to shut that down. We just, but it was also a situation where I did. It's funny because going back to theater and acting and these way these things affect, the thing I kept thinking about was I had a scene that I had done one summer. I decided to do an acting conservatory for fun while I was in New York, and actually the scene started off. This is exactly what it was. Like the husband and wife come home, and they're getting ready for bed, and the wife is drunk and she's putting on her makeup and she's putting it on and it's all screwed up. And like, I mean, this is not stuff that's in the scene, like written in the scene, but it's something that like the actor makes a choice. Yeah. What was happening was you had this girl who was drunk. The husband was sober. He drove home or whatever. She's drunk and she's trying to be sexy and seduce him. And she doesn't realize that like, she just looks like a sloppy drunk. Right. And so I was like, again, it made me this experience with her. The reason why I probably laughed was because I thought of the scene.
Oh, it reminds you of the scene. Yeah.
It reminds me of the scene. She thinks that she's being sexy and I'm laughing because I thought of the scene that I experienced. And so,
I acknowledge you for cleaning that up with her because it's the sort of thing where you could kind of go, oh, it's not a big deal. We don't need to deal with this because sweep it under the carpet. But those things actually accumulate over time when we're having these interactions that don't go as well as we'd like for whatever reason and we're leaving someone else feeling in an unpleasant state. So I acknowledge the leader of this club, for instance, as well, because she did come to me afterwards and talk over what was going on. And so we could, you know, get a bit of clarity about it and I could be assertive with her and say, yeah, I don't actually like it when you do that. And, you know, like you could clear it up with that girl that you were having this other thing about another scene and it wasn't about her being sexy, really. And you were just not really part of the environment because you hadn't been drinking for all that long. So that she, like you described, she doesn't have to end up traumatized by this little thing. And a lot of little things can add up to a feeling of, oh, it's not safe to be me. Well,
it's like your place, right? Like you think about the place that you live. And if you, I had a roommate who was pretty young. I mean, this is a long time ago, but he maybe 10 years ago. But he was quite a bit younger than me at the time. And I told him at one point, I said, look, every day we can make the apartment like 1% better. Mm. And over the course of time, we'll just continue to build a better home, or you can let it deteriorate 1% a day. Mm. And then over time, we're going to live in a shithole. Mm. And I think relationships are the same way. And it's hard, right? Like to constantly be working or leaning towards improvement because it's work, right? It's work. It takes an actual effort. And sometimes we just want to be slobs or want to be lazy or want to take a break. Yeah. But our relationships, I think, are the same way. We can spend, and it doesn't mean that I think it's feasible for us to constantly be improving every single relationship in our lives. Sometimes some relationships are going to die off and then they're going to come back and some will never come back. But for the relationships that we choose to nurture at a given time, those relationships, I think it's a process of constantly, to a certain extent, there is always some level of cleanup, right? You're constantly having to try to improve them. And sometimes it's going to be natural because you're just going to have positive experiences. And sometimes you're going to have negative experiences. And when you have those negative experiences, or one person perceives them as negative or whatever, you're not on the same wavelength or plane, or then we use language to try to we use language as one of the tools in order to try to sort of clean that up and improve it. And I mean, that's one of the realizations that I've made. And I'm only sharing that with sort of you and as a consequence of listeners, because hopefully that it's helpful for them in some way.
Yeah, totally. And there's a bigger picture theory that the people that we attract into a relationship with, not just intimate partners, but people generally, to some degree will hit our hot buttons and will bring up this stuff for us to deal with, the sort of the trauma stuff that we started talking about at the beginning. So I think you're right. There's going to be times when it's easy and plain sailing and relationship is fun. If you're not having any fun, if it's all work, then something's not right. But invariably, you know, the house metaphor is a good one. You know, your house gets dirty and you've got to bring out the vacuum cleaner and clean it every now and then so that you can enjoy having a nice place.
I think that's essentially what I'm trying to articulate. There's something else I wanted to articulate too, and that was that with this teacher, it's great that she was able to do that and you were able to respond by telling her, this bothers me. But it also is important to realize that once you get out of this class, you might not have a relationship with her and that might not matter. Hmm. Right? And so what you don't want to do is let this person who sort of floated through your life for 4 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks while you had this class affect you long term. And I find that as I get older, I realize that there are experiences in my life that that's happened. I remember having, when I was at Columbia, I had this writing teacher who I thought I was a pretty good writer, and she gave me a lot of negative feedback, and I realized it took me years. I just sort of stopped writing and didn't realize I stopped writing. It wasn't until I started working with some writing teachers way later on that I realized like I could write. And these are people who were fairly well respected. One of them used to be an editor for this guy, David Foster Wallace, is a very famous writer. He ended up killing himself. And, but he was on the cover of Time magazine. He's like, I mean, very, very famous writer. And she used to edit his work, and having her, that knowing that she used to edit his work, and she didn't edit all his work, but noticed that she used to edit his work, and sort of reading his work and respect it and the complexity, and like I like, and having her tell me, you write well, like you're like, and her really being into some of my work, or giving me the impression that she was, helped me recognize and deal with that. This other teacher, even though I was in her class for half a semester, or maybe it was even almost the entire semester, really sort of traumatized me in a certain way.
Yeah,
and it caused me to inhibit myself. And I had another teacher. It's funny because I've been talking more and more about acting. One thing I want to add: Tom Hanks had this quote on this thing he said on Inside the Actor's Studio, where he said, "Like, what? Why does he like acting?" And he said it's because it allows him to do like. I'm not quoting him verbatim, but go through all these experiences in life or do all these fucked up things without any of the consequences. And it was a way for him to sort of explore. And my interpretation of that is it was a way for him to explore the human condition in a way that he doesn't always get to do in sort of his normal life. But the other thing I wanted to mention was I had this teacher who talked about this book. It was a play. I can't think of the name of it, but this guy drags around this goat, and I bring it up in the podcast, and I said, one of these days I'm gonna go back and read it. But what he said really resonated with me, and maybe it was just his interpretation, but he said, you know, this play, this guy drags around this goat on stage through all these different experiences. And he goes, it's not a literal, people might look at it as a literal goat and they miss the whole point. It's all the things that we drag around in life as we get older. Right. In the Christmas story, it's the chains that one of the ghosts is dragging around. Right. It's like, it's just this crap that we accumulate and we have to clean up.
Yeah.
And you clean up like as human beings, we're constantly cleaning up as with ourselves. I have to clean it up. You have to clean it up. And we help our clients clean it up. Right. And try to give them direction as they clean it up. And there isn't sort of like one person or one thing. Going back to the story of the Hobbit, the Gandalf or whatever, we're going to find sort of one person who's going to guide us through the journey. But oftentimes the people who are guides are going to have their own issues and they're going to go off and deal with those things and disappear for a while and come back. But
my experience. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Is there anything? I know we ran way over on time.
Yeah, look, it's been so fascinating talking to you. Like, I just keep thinking of more things I want to say, but I'm also like, okay, my boundaries. I'm going to need to go soon.
Is there anything you want to add? We're sort of wrapped up. I think there's definitely some things in here that people will use. But is there anything you want to add before we sort of wrap this up?
Yeah, we've covered a lot of things. Well, the thing that was on my mind about what you just said was, these opportunities with people in our adult lives now are also opportunities to heal the stuff that we didn't get as a kid. So it wasn't okay. It didn't feel safe for me to say to my mom when I was a kid, hey, I don't actually like the way you're treating me. Like, this freaked me out totally. So to be able to say to this other woman, because we unconsciously project stuff onto other people, to be able to say to her, I don't actually like the way you're treating me. And for her to say, I'm sorry. I won't do that again. You know, that's a really healing thing to just be assertive. So, yeah, there's going back and doing childhood regression to deal with trauma. There's also just facing these events when they come up in your daily life. And that's what I coach my clients on a lot. It's being assertive in their daily life so that they get quick results and they're empowered and they're no longer going, oh, I just keep rerunning my mum pattern all the time. Like, all right, well, we're going to stop doing that. So yeah, look, I really love talking to you. I could talk for weeks on this stuff because I find it fascinating. I think people are interesting. And I really appreciate the opportunity to connect with you, Christopher. It's been a blast.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. This has been totally awesome. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me. And if you're listening to this and you want to learn more about Graham and And we're going to post some links in the on the Crouch Christmas website and within the description of this podcast.
Cool.
So you can find out more about him and his coaching, the things he's doing. Is there anything else you want to add?
Just the thought that increasingly I'm leaning towards coaching performing artists. And if people hit my website, grahamstoney.com, for that kind of stuff. Yeah, I'd love to talk more and see what we can do working together.
Awesome. Sweet. Awesome. Thank you again for coming on the show.
Thanks, Christopher. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, man.